The leader joining us today showed America what can happen when we focus on the economy and work with both parties. He brought together both sides to achieve a balanced budget and make our government more efficient. That led to record budget surpluses and, just as important, record low poverty. As president, he oversaw the creation of 22 million new jobs in our great country, the biggest expansion in modern history. But for him, it wasn't about the numbers. It was about the hardworking families in Hampton and Rico and Harrisonburg. That's why he fought so hard for the Family and Medical Leave Act, so that when you have a child, you can actually take time off and not worry about losing your job. And it's why he fought for Pell Grants and new teachers to give every child a chance regardless of their race, religion, gender, or where they were born. He understands the struggles of middle-class families. You know why? Because he's lived them. He was raised by a single mom in Arkansas and was able to afford college with scholarships and hard work. He has never forgotten where he came from, and he has never forgotten hardworking families. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my honor to bring back to Harrisonburg the 42nd President of the United States of America, Bill Clinton.
Thank you. Wow, thank you. Thank you. First of all, I want to thank President and Mrs. Aldrin for welcoming me here to JMU. I love being here. I thought Shelby Wilts did a great job in her opening remarks, and I appreciated what she said, especially about the Violence Against Women Act that she and Terry talked about. I'm very proud of that bill, and I'm appalled that anybody would oppose both extending it and expanding its reach. Thank you, Charnel Herring, for your leadership. Thank you to the Harrisburg Democratic Chair, Deb Fitzgerald, and thank you, Delegate Clint Miller. But most of all, thank all of you. Terry gave such a good speech, he doesn't need me anymore, does he? I can just leave now. I want to make just a few points briefly. First, one that he can't make on his own behalf. Terry McAuliffe and I are friends. He and his family and Hillary and Chelsea and I, we vacation together. We've been through ups and downs together. I proudly participated in his father's funeral service in the magnificent Catholic Cathedral in Syracuse, New York. I know his mother, Millie McAuliffe, who at 91 would like to be here sticking up for her boy and was glad to be used as an example of Social Security today. And here's what I know. First of all, he meets the first test of leadership. He overmarried. And I want you to welcome his wife, Dorothy, here. Stand up, Dorothy. And his literal big brother, John, Terry's brothers have been doing replacement duty every day. I got a different one, seems like, just to make sure he's all right. His niece, Marissa, there was a Peace Corps volunteer. And in Ukraine, and Hillary and I recently took her back there, and it was quite a hoot seeing this Irish girl talking to the Ukrainians in their own voice, and she works for Hillary now. So They have five children, one of whom is in his third year at the United States Naval Academy. So here's what I know. If you elect Terry McAuliffe in a week, within a year of his becoming governor, half the people who vote against him a week from now will wonder what they were thinking about. You will be proud you did. He is a good man. He will be a good leader. And you can see it in the values that he's lived in his family life and the way he's raised his five great kids. He is a good man. Second thing I want to say is I'm qualified to be here because I was governor of my native state for 12 years. Some people thought I couldn't get a promotion. I stayed so long. I never got tired of being governor, and what I know, because my region of the country was in the shape the whole country is now for much of the 1980s. We were manufacturing jobs were being devastated. Our farmers were in trouble. It was awful. And I don't care what anybody else says, the governor's real job is to empower people to succeed and then try to build an economy that gives them a place to go. And under the worst of circumstances, there is always something you can do to improve educational opportunities, which is why I approve of what Terry's advocating, everything from more preschool through the school years, more affordable access to college, and going to these community colleges, about which I will say a little more in a minute. There's always something you can do to improve infrastructure and to increase the investment in science and technology and innovation for a state. And Virginia has so many assets. It's really important that somebody get up every day thinking about how to build them up instead of how to tear the people up over some issue that won't shape the future, though it could wreak terrible injustice. And finally, it matters who's trying to get the jobs. I'll tell you exactly why a lot of those Republicans were at that deal last night. It is kind of funny, isn't it, that we had President Bush's finance chair doing a fundraiser for Terry? It was a great event. It was about half Republicans and half Democrats. About every 5 minutes, they'd look around and say, can you believe we're in the same room with these people? It was funny. They were there because they know that he will take care of the main business of the Commonwealth of Virginia, and he'll do a good job of it, and his opponent has a very different idea of what the job of the governor is, one that you would have to pay for. So I'm just telling you, I've done this job. And I started out, and our state had nowhere near the assets you did, so we had to build the first statewide network of community colleges. And we gave scholarships for tuition for everybody that graduated from any high school with a B average or more. And we took the bottom 25% of our people, the bottom 25%, out from under the state income tax. And we led the nation in job growth when I ran for president in 1992. But before that, there had been only 1 month and 8 years when our unemployment rate had been below the national average. This is hard work, but a governor can make a difference if the governor has the right priorities and can execute them. And he does, and he will. But the third thing that we've been talking about and around today is this is all rooted in your approach. And this election, for all of you who are students here, is kind of a metaphor of the 21st century world. Virginia was clever at some point in the past and decided to have its governor's races in the year after the presidential race. And only New Jersey does that, guarantees you plenty of coverage. And you're about to get plenty of coverage now because you have such interesting candidates. And they are so different. I think that's an understatement. But they are a metaphor for the struggles of the 21st century world across the globe. Here's why. For all of you who are younger, who are students here, you live in the most interdependent age in human history, within and across borders. Borders look more like nets than walls. That means, as we have seen to our joy and peril, good things and bad things can happen. an 8-year-old can get on the internet and find out something in 30 seconds, I had to go to college to learn. That's the good news. Bad news is you can get on the internet and learn how to make a roadside bomb and kill a lot of innocent people. And there are thousands of other examples which you understand very well. In other words, interdependence means that whether we like it or not, we are going to share the future. So the real question is, what are the terms on which we will share the future? What do you want? I think the only objective that makes sense is to say we want shared opportunity, shared prosperity, shared responsibilities, and a shared sense of community. We don't want to obliterate our differences. They are important, and they make life more interesting. But we have to believe that our common humanity matters more than that. That's the only way to get through this thicket. Now, if you believe that, then you look around the whole world and look in America, and you see there are two dominant ways of proceeding. You can be for the politics of creative cooperation, in which you don't ask people to give up their philosophy. You don't ask people not ever to disagree with you. You don't ask for an end of debate. You want it. You want it. You know we're not, none of us are right all the time. And you know it's healthy in a society to have some of us who, in the Democratic Party, we're really concerned that poor people aren't left out and left behind. We think it really is terrible that middle-class people go a decade without a pay raise. We don't like it when people have to drop out of college, and now increasingly even community colleges, because they think they can't ever pay their debts. But it's also a good thing to have people who say, look, most people do have jobs. The economy is working for most people. We don't want to solve the problem at the expense of messing up the engine of growth, and we've got to be fiscally responsible. We've got to pay our bills and make things work out. And if you have that debate and you focus on any specific challenge and people have good hearts and goodwill, chances are you'll come to the best available decision, the cooperators. And then you have people who say, no, I'm right. I don't have a philosophy. I have an ideology. If you have an ideology, it means you know the answer before you see the evidence. Just the fact that you believe in it makes it right. And your politics are the politics of constant conflict. There's something wrong with people that disagree with you. And that's what you've got here. You take this Medicaid fight. Should Virginia participate in the new Affordable Health Care Act version of Medicaid expansion? I want to make it simple because I don't think most people understand what's at stake. Right now, there are a lot of people without insurance. For hospitals like university teaching hospitals and big city hospitals that see a lot of those uninsured people, they usually do see them in the emergency room. Because those people don't get health care till they're too sick to go anywhere else, and most of them cannot afford to pay. Now, under the old system, they got a specific check from the federal government called a DSH payment, a disproportionate share payment, because they bore a disproportionate share of the burden of uninsured care. Now they don't need that anymore if poor people are covered by Medicaid. So when Mr. Cuccinelli or anybody else says, we don't want to participate in this, we don't want this Medicaid money, what they're really saying is, okay, Virginia, you gave us the money at the federal level, and you don't want it back? You want us to send it to Nevada and New Mexico and California? You want us to take your money and send it somewhere else? And you want us to leave your hospitals holding the bag for the cost of the uninsured, which means everybody else's insurance costs are going to go up? That's what this is about. Divide and conquer. Make people so blind, but philosophically you don't understand. You have to hate the federal government. Don't bother me with the facts of this. If Medicaid is for... No. If Medicaid is for poor people, it's by definition welfare. Let me tell you something. Everybody on welfare, they're already on Medicaid. This is to expand Medicaid to at least 133% of the federal poverty level, which is low-wage working people. I'm telling you something, the bravest people in this country are the people that go out and work 40 hours a week and try to feed their kids and clothe their kids and make no money doing it, and they deserve the right to have health care. That is important. Those are the facts. You know, look, when I was born at the end of World War II, the per capita income of Arkansas, my native state, was barely half the national average. When I was a little boy, my grandfather ran a country store in a predominantly African-American neighborhood. There were no food stamps. I hear them screaming about food stamps now. The people who couldn't afford their food, who came in my grandfather's store, and I saw them when I was a little boy, and I saw my grandfather give them food and just write it down in a little ledger, run the debts up. And I said, "Why are you doing this?" He said, "They are working people. They have no money. They work as hard as they can. They don't get paid much, and they have a right to feed their children. Anybody who's doing the best they can deserves the right to feed their children and provide them health care and be taken care of." We have too many people like that today. But if you have an ideology, it's, oh, the government helping the poor, we got to be against it. If you look at the facts, you got to be for it. Doesn't matter whether you're right, left, or somewhere in the middle. That's what this election's about. And I could give you lots of other examples. If you're ideological, you want one set of rules for you and another set for everybody else. I'll give you an example. The same fellow that proposed to fingerprint poor people who couldn't pay their debts to the emergency room wanted to pin a medal on those people in Congress who didn't want America to pay its debts. That's what this debt ceiling deal's all about. The debt ceiling is a misnomer. The debt ceiling, here's the deal. Terry and I went to a Red Lobster the other day. We all did. We had a good time, and you know I changed my diet, but I did eat a couple of bites of one of the biscuits, even though I probably shouldn't have. And it's like we put it on a credit card bill, okay? And Red Lobster gets paid. And then at the end of the month, we get the credit card bill, and we decide, well, that wasn't such a good meal after all. I don't think I'll pay it. That's what Congress was talking about doing, and that's why it was so devastating to us around the world. Now they want to cut all these working people off food stamps. You think they want the food stamps? You think they like the fact that they're putting in full time at work and they still don't have enough money to feed their kids? You really think that it's somehow charity and welfare for us to make sure these kids are not malnourished when they show up at school and their brains are developing and we want them to learn and we want them to succeed and we want them to feel like they're part of our American community? I mean, what is this? It's a metaphor. All over the world, there's a global shortage of jobs, especially for the young. In America, there's a big job problem for middle-aged people who need to work another 10 or 20 years, who lost their jobs in the financial crash and either can't get new ones or can't get ones paying what they made before. These are serious problems. They do not have easy solutions. They have global implications. Does anybody seriously think we're going to address these problems if we spend all our time fighting over this other stuff and majoring in the minors? No, we got to get the best people together, put our heads together, figure out what works. I'll tell you what works. I work now through my foundation on every continent. I work all over the world, and I travel America a lot. You just look at the places in America that are in better shape today than they were before the crash. Without exception, there are places where there is extraordinary cooperation. Business, government, labor, universities, philanthropic groups, everybody's working together to figure out what are we good at and build on it and get something done. Terry McAuliffe has often been derided in this campaign by the other side who say they're principled and he's a deal maker. Now, when you watched that mess in Washington in the last couple of weeks, didn't you say, oh, for one deal maker? Virginia was the home of many of the most important founders of this country. The founding fathers set up a system that requires honorable compromise. Dividing powers at the national and state level, dividing powers between the executive, legislative, and judicial, making it harder to get anything done through the differences in the way the Senate and the House work. I mean, they set it up because they were most worried about abuse of power. They have enough flexibility in our Constitution that we can grow and meet the changes of each new age, but only if we can make principled compromises. The subtitle of the U.S. Constitution might well be The Art of the Deal. And we can laugh about it, but you can't run anything over the long term and build it up unless you include people who are different from you. And you bring people with different strengths, different knowledges, different experiences, different opinions together for the purpose of getting something done, not of endless conflict. That's the most important thing here, folks. Terry McAuliffe will major in the majors, not the minors. And these Republicans know perfectly well what position he's taken on all the issues. He'd been very forthright and very outspoken, as he was today, on any number of issues. But they think he will get the show on the road. There is this hunger in America to see our country moving again. And Virginia has I'll say it again, you got so many assets. It is crazy to be bogged down. And for all of you who are young, you just remember this. If you want an interdependent world of shared prosperity, shared opportunities, and shared responsibilities, you have got to have one that is inclusive and works on a cooperation model, not a conflict model. So, last thing I want to say is this. If the public opinion surveys are right, more Virginians agree with Terry than with his opponent. But some people have voted, but most people haven't yet. And that's why he wanted you to all wave your little cards. And when Hillary was here a few days ago, she said, I wave my card. You wave your card when you get down here, so I'm doing this. You can give me a good report. Here's why it's important. In the presidential elections in 2008 and 2012, 72% of the registered voters in Virginia voted. You know what the number was in the last governor's race in 2009? 40%. 4-0. A full third of the registered voters fell off, and over 40% of those voting fell off. That's why we're still here. That's why you have to do this. Nothing's happened yet. And every one of you here, if you make up your mind to, could get 10 more people to go to the polls who would otherwise be disinclined to vote by talking about these subjects. And especially you young people. You all clapped when Terry said he wanted to protect voting rights. I guess it's because you've read what happened when people like his opponent get elected governor and control the legislature in other states. But let me just give you two examples so you'll know how personal this is to your personal empowerment. In Texas, after the Supreme Court decided we didn't need the Voting Rights Act anymore, they immediately implemented their photo ID requirements, admitting that since you have to have a state-issued photo ID, if you are a poor Latino worker south of San Antonio in Texas and you don't have a driver's license, you would have to go 50 miles each way, an average of 100 miles, to get a photo ID. But there are two exceptions in Texas to the requirements of a government-issued photo ID. You know what they are? If you got a if you have a photo ID from a Texas State Institution of Higher Education, it doesn't count. You can't vote with it. The other one is if you got a concealed carry permit, which doesn't have your picture, you don't need a photo ID. Please vote by all means. I couldn't make this up, folks. Then in North Carolina, 2 years south, you know, North Carolina has always been the, in a way, one of the glorious success stories of higher education in the American South. It is thick with colleges, and it's long state from east to west. In North Carolina, they have a state income tax, and you get to deduct your kids. You get to take the child tax deduction. Under the new photo ID law, if your child is a student in an institution of higher education in North Carolina, you can only deduct your child if he or she comes home to vote. But if he stays or she stays in the college town and they run their numbers up and they dictate the outcome of the local races, you lose your tax deduction. This is all about voter fraud, you understand. This has nothing to do with stripping people of their right to have their voice heard. This is a big election, and it is a metaphor for all of you for the way the next 20 or 30 years in America and all around the world is going to play out. There are a lot of problems. It's frustrating solving hard problems. You don't succeed every day. And it's better to divert people and divide them and get them all torn up and upset. And the one political shining virtue of extremism is that if you can get people so torn up and upset that there's steam coming out of their ears instead of light bulbs going off in their heads, they all vote every time the polls are open. And people who are more calm, more rational, see things in a fair and balanced and a little bit of this, a little bit of that way, they often don't vote. You have to make sure that if you want a cooperation model to beat a conflict model for Virginia's future, you show up and you bring other people to the polls. It is the whole deal, and the young people here have the biggest stake in this. So will you do it? This is about you, and you will be so proud when you elect Terry McAuliffe and that whole team. They are looking out for your future. You should have a government that is about you and about getting the smartest people from all over Virginia and the people with the widest variety of experience to put their heads together to solve problems that are global in scope, because you are better positioned to take advantage of the 21st century world than nearly any place in America. I still think it can be the most prosperous, the most exciting, the most peaceful time in human history, but only if we choose cooperation over conflict. Thank you, and God bless you.